Believe it or not, I think this is the first time I've ever been in this chamber. And probably has something to do with the fact that the other guys controlled it for 95 straight years. I mean, maybe that's why I just never got around to it. Daniel, thank you very much for that extraordinarily kind introduction. Daniel and I had a chance to work together for a number of years, and he was, as an undergraduate, a McConnell Scholar at U of L, so we've labored in the vineyards together for quite some time. I want to start this morning on a sober moment before turning to what I want to talk to you about with regard to the courts. We witnessed, all of us, two horrendous shootings this weekend, one in the synagogue in Pittsburgh and one in the Kroger store in Louisville. If these aren't definitions of hate crimes, I don't know what a hate crime is. And I know that's a legal determination to be made by others, but that certainly is my opinion. And I'm also somebody who still embraces the death penalty. I know that's kind of out of fashion in our country, but I think there are times in which it seems to me that's an appropriate response. Now, turning to other matters, and these two occasions, in my view, would be appropriate for the death penalty. When I was a young staffer, this was the first 2 years of the Nixon administration, believe it or not, I was working for a Kentucky senator who was on the Judiciary Committee and had my first experience with advice and consent. Nixon had two Supreme Court nominees defeated, one of whom, in my view, unjustly, and the other one quite appropriately. So I ended up writing a law journal article for the UK law journal about advice and consent, and that began a lengthy period of time during which I've dealt with this in a variety of different ways. And in looking back on that law journal article, all of my conclusions were totally wrong. I think it's safe to say that advice and consent means whatever a majority of the Senate thinks it means at any given time. It's sort of like impeachment. People keep kind of groping for some legal standard. Impeachment is a political process, and so is advice and consent. So I think it's safe to say advice and consent means whatever the Senate thinks it means at any given time. And if you go back to the beginning of our country, it has been dealt with in a variety of different ways, from names being sent up and confirmed on voice votes with nothing at all other than that, to protracted struggles, confirmations without incident, and battles royal. So fast forward a couple of years, and I'm in the Justice Department during the Ford administration, and this was a period right after Nixon had resigned, and there were a lot of several legal luminaries in the department. They were so brilliant, I never opened my mouth for fear of saying something stupid. In the Justice Department, in those staff meetings, those mornings, were Robert Bork, who was the Solicitor General, a fellow named Antonin Scalia, who was head of the Office of Legal Counsel, and a guy named Lawrence Silberman, who was the Deputy Attorney General, who subsequently was on the D.C. Circuit for a number of years. And all of this brilliance in one room, coupled with extraordinary humor, I felt completely intimidated and never opened my mouth for fear of looking foolish in front of that crowd. As all of you now know, since you're Federalist Society members, this all really began with Bork and Scalia. Scalia when he was a law professor at Chicago, and Bork when he was a law professor at Yale, around the quaint notion that maybe the job of a judge is to apply the laws as written. You wouldn't think that'd be controversial. But actually, it was significantly out of fashion at the time of the beginning of the Federalist Society. And I've watched it during the course of my public career expand into law schools and communities all around the country, creating a network that you all, at least most of you, probably are part of. The rest of you are interested observers. And this whole network, I think, produced a lot of men and women who have this quaint notion as a core principle for how the judiciary ought to deal with cases. If you haven't read Scalia Speaks, I hope you will, put together a combination of all of his speeches, which were fabulous. Now, one of the things he used to say that I really liked was, you're not a very good judge if you're not occasionally uncomfortable with the outcome you reach. Not your personal opinion. It's the way the law is written. He also said frequently, if you want to make policy, why don't you run for office? Some of you may have been there when I had Justice Gorsuch down in Kentucky last year. He put it this way. He said, we don't wear red robes or blue robes, we wear black robes. Now, you wouldn't think this would be all that controversial, but actually it is. President Obama, for example, said the kind of judges he would appoint would be those who had empathy. Well, think about that for a minute. If you're the litigant for whom the judge does not have empathy, it's not so good. Not so good. If you're the other guy, that's you're lucky. So, you know, pretty much intentionally taking the view that appointing activist judges is exactly what they had in mind in order to enhance their chances of success when they can't get it through the elected officials. So that's been kind of the yin and yang of this during the course of my public career. Well, after the experience at the Justice Department, a few years later, I find myself in the Senate. And I'm on the Judiciary Committee for briefly. I didn't stay very long, but I was on there briefly and was there when we confirmed Rehnquist to be Chief Justice and Scalia to be Associate Justice. And the Scalia vote, as you all may recall, was unanimous. So it was kind of a quasi-peaceful period. There was a bit of a fight over Rehnquist's elevation from Associate Justice to Chief Justice, producing 20, 25 negative votes, but not an all-out, knockdown, drag-out fight. I left the committee after the first 2 years, and I missed the Bork experience, which happened in 87. Most of you were in grade school then, but the Bork fight was an all-out fight. No holds barred. The things that were said about Bork were pretty incendiary. And one could argue in retrospect that Bork made it easy for him because he decided to treat the hearing as an opportunity to demonstrate his brilliance. And so he viewed it as Professor Bork before a bunch of students who needed to be enlightened. That led to what's now called the Ginsburg rule, which is you don't answer squat. And there hadn't been a judge nominated since Bork by any president who's answered anything, witnessing what happened when Bork decided to sort of demonstrate his intellectual brilliance in front of a largely hostile crowd with the naive notion, I guess, that he was going to persuade them. So during my period in the Senate, I think it is safe to say advice and consent has been, for the most part, the Senate has really asserted itself. Now, there have been some exceptions, but for the most part, this has been a period during which I think you could accurately describe it as a period of senatorial assertiveness. And I remind people periodically that what's unique about the Senate is we're in the personnel business. The House is not. There are 1,200 executive branch appointments that come to us for confirmation. So setting up the government, the boards, the commission, the agencies, the cabinet, all the rest, is very much a part of life in the Senate. And it's one of the most important things we do. Obviously, among those, the most important thing is the Supreme Court. So during the Clinton years, was pretty quiet. Ginsburg was confirmed. Breyer was confirmed. I voted for both of them. I think there were two or three people that voted against either one of them. And you might have reached the conclusion this was going to be a little less contentious. You might also reach the conclusion that the Republicans are rather naive in concluding that if they were nice to Democratic presidents, there would be reciprocity. Didn't turn out that way. You move into the Bush years, and we were able to confirm both Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, but we did have to get cloture on Alito, meaning we had to get 60 votes, but they did allow us to get 60 votes. So I want to take a minute and talk about cloture in connection with the executive calendar. Remember, in the Senate, we have two calendars. We have an executive calendar and a legislative calendar. The House only has a legislative calendar. On the executive calendar, until Bush 43 got elected, even though it was possible to defeat a nominee with a filibuster, it was never done in the history of the United States. Let me say that again. Even though it was possible, to defeat a nominee by requiring 60 votes, it had not been done in the history of the United States down to Bush 43. Well, when Bush 43 got elected, my now counterpart, Chuck Schumer, then the junior senator from New York, convened a seminar. And he invited some people that you've heard of, Lawrence Tribe, Cass Sunstein. And they had a little discussion in the Democratic senatorial minority and said, well, look, it's possible to filibuster judges. Why don't we do it? Because Bush is going to send up all these crazy right-wingers, all these Federalist Society people, and we sure ought to use every tool in the toolbox to defeat them. So that began a period of very aggressive senatorial activism, which you may remember. The poster child for that was Miguel Estrada. We had seven sort of all-night sessions, you know, for theatrics, but it wasn't going to change the outcome. And there was a good deal of discussion within our conference, we were in the majority at the time, about the so-called nuclear option. Let me describe for you what the nuclear option is. The rules of the Senate, according to the rules of the Senate, require 67 votes to change. But the nuclear option is a mere majority of the Senate waiving the rules and changing the rules. In other words, breaking the rules of the Senate in order to change the rules of the Senate. We flirted with that when we were in the majority during Bush. What ended up happening, we had a big settlement, and some of those circuit judges were confirmed, and some of them were not, and we just didn't go to the brink during that period. Move past the Bush years to the Obama years. We're in the minority. We stopped two circuit judges in 5.5 years by requiring 60 votes. A whole lot of others were confirmed. Only two were stopped. But my then counterpart, Harry Reid, in his desire to stack the DC circuit, decided to pull the nuclear trigger, lower the threshold for the executive calendar for everything except the Supreme Court. And they rushed through three DC circuit court members. I said at the time, I didn't like the way they did it. I said at the time, you know, someday the shoe will be on the other foot. Funny how that happens. A year and a half later, we come to the majority. And I got a bunch of my members pulling my sleeve saying, why don't we change it back? And I said, well, let's think about this a minute. We might not have liked the way they did it, but for those of you who've gotten here recently, this is the way it was for 200 and some odd years down to Bush 43. Nobody ever stopped anybody on the executive counter, including judges, by requiring 60 votes. So even though I didn't like the way they did it, I'm not so uncomfortable with where we are, because I think the executive calendar is different from the legislative calendar and ought to be dealt with a simple majority. So I managed to beat down this little sagebrush rebellion to reverse it back. So now we're at where we were all those years down to 2001 with a simple majority for everybody except the Supreme Court. And then, as we all recall, Justice Scalia passed away in the middle of the presidential election campaign in 2016. We had just started a week off, and so my members were scattered around the world and around the country. Elaine and I had gone on a trip that we frequently make in February. We landed, I looked at my iPhone, and Scalia was gone. Went to the hotel and began to think about some of the things that I've talked to you about this morning, including watching that brilliance on full display back during the Ford administration in the Justice Department, and thinking about the Federalist Society and all that came from what he and Bork started back in those early days, but also the practical situation we had before us. And the first thing that came into my mind was, if the shoe was on the other foot, and this was a vacancy created in a presidential election year, and there was a Republican president, a Democratic Senate, would they be filling this vacancy? It didn't take me long to reach the conclusion that was not going to happen. So I sent out, in a hail of criticism, as you all recall, sent out a statement basically saying, whoever's elected this fall will fill this vacancy. By the time we got back a week later, I had some interesting facts to sort of back up what I had already concluded before we had done much research. And we noted that the ever helpful Joe Biden, when he was chairman of the Judiciary Committee in 92, when the Democrats were in the majority in the Senate and we had a Republican president, he ever helpfully volunteered that if a vacancy occurred, they wouldn't fill it. And then in 2007, about 18 months before the end of Bush 43, Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer helpfully volunteered that if a vacancy occurred, they wouldn't fill it. I was beginning to feel on even firmer footing. And then we did a little more research, and we found out you'd have to go back to the 1880s. To find the last time when you had a Senate in control of one party and a president in control of a different party, that a vacancy was filled that had been created in the middle of the presidential election year. So I felt like I was in pretty firm footing. As you know, that was an extraordinarily controversial decision. Everybody on the other side claimed I was breaking the Senate and destroying tradition and all the rest. In fact, all I was doing was following exactly what had happened going back to the 1880s when you had a similar situation where a vacancy was created in the middle of a presidential election year. So, ironically, and I couldn't have predicted this at the time, at the time I made the call, we didn't know who our nominee was going to be yet. Within a few months, it looks like Donald Trump is going to be the nominee. So I got a bunch of people pulling, this guy's doing fundraisers for Chuck Schumer 3 years ago. What are we getting here? And at that point, you enter a guy you're now familiar with named Don McGahn, who was the counsel for the campaign. A Federalist Society guy, a guy I had recommended for the Federal Election Commission that I knew not well, but pretty well. And Don linked up with the Federalist Society, and you may recall, came up with the list. The list of people the president would pick for the Supreme Court. Believe it or not, by the fall, that list ended up being the single biggest reason most Republicans, 9 out of 10, ended up voting for Donald Trump, even like they voted for Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney and Donald Trump got the same percentage of Republicans. And the principal reason the Republicans came home to a rather unusual nominee, who was unsettling in many respects, was he's going to appoint the right kind of person to the Supreme Court. So fast forward to election night, I had three things on my mind. I was hoping this body would become Republican for the first time in 95 years, and I tried to do my part to be helpful. And the first call I got was from Jeff Hoover about 8:30 in the evening, and Jeff said, not only did we take it, we took it big. And I thought, well, that's 1 out of 3. That's not too bad. Because I thought we were going to lose the Senate. I mean, we had 24 members up. They only had 10. You might enjoy the following story. Since the map was so good for them in 2016, Schumer, who was going to be the Democratic leader, was so confident he was going to have my job that the last week before the election, he had an interview with a different reporter each day to highlight his agenda. He called me up the day before the election and said, I hope we're going to have a really good relationship. I called him up the day after the election and said, I sure hope so. So whammo, by 11 o'clock, we held the Senate. Never occurred to me that Donald Trump might be elected president. And he was. So within a week of the election, I called up McGahn and I said, Don, we have an opportunity here to do something really important for the country. I think the most long-lasting impact we could have would be lifetime appointments to the courts, particularly the circuit courts and the Supreme Court. Legislation comes and goes. You know, I hoped we were going to be able to do comprehensive tax reform, which we did, but I remembered that the last time that was done in 86, it lasted 4 years before the political wind shifted. And it was completely undone by a new majority that came in with a different point of view about how to deal with taxes. But if we want to have a real impact on the country long term, let's see if we can do this the right way. And I said to him, in various administrations, I thought the White House counsel's office was too slow. If you consolidate the selection process at the White House rather than kind of having the Justice Department involved in it too, and so many different cooks spoiling the broth, you can make a quicker decision. And if you can get them up to us, I think we can expedite for a couple of reasons. Some of you may remember the blue slip policy, which is a custom of the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, which had been treated by some chairmen as an opportunity for senators to veto a choice from their particular state, particularly at the district court level. At the circuit court level, it was more mixed as to what the blue slip was, because most administrations believe the circuit courts are their picks and the district courts are our picks. So I said to McGahn, I'm going to try to convince Chairman Grassley that a blue slip for a circuit court judge is simply an announcement of how you're going to vote. Because remember, 4 years ago, they said 41 senators shouldn't be able to stop a judge. How could you argue that one should? Remember, they pulled the nuclear trigger, lowered the threshold, eliminated the possibility that 41 senators could stop a judge. Then how could you rationally argue that one should be able to, particularly at the circuit court level? So, we eliminated that roadblock, that potential roadblock. And here we are, we've done one other episode, you may remember, the possibility to stop a Supreme Court justice was still there when Gorsuch was nominated. That was the one exception they made. And I thought the smart play for Schumer, given the fact that Gorsuch was almost totally without controversy, would have been to give us cloture, in other words, give us 60 votes to confirm Gorsuch. But remember, when Trump got elected president, the resistance started. And the resistance has been intense. And it has seeped into the Senate. And I think Senate Democrats felt they just simply didn't have the latitude to make probably what would have been a smart play, which was to not burn the filibuster on Gorsuch. Because there might be another Supreme Court justice, you never know. And so it was clear we were not going to get 60 votes. I said to my conference, look, we all objected to pulling the nuclear trigger 4 years ago. I understand that. But look, if a guy like Gorsuch can't get 60 votes, there isn't anybody this president could nominate who could get 60 votes. Nobody. So that allowed me to get the 51 votes I needed for us to even it up. And now everything on the executive calendar is done with a simple majority. The and then fast forward, and you know what came next. Justice Kennedy decided to retire. Justice Kavanaugh was nominated. We were moving along rather smoothly. In the lead up to it, it won't surprise you all to know I was lobbying for one of our circuit judges from this circuit, Amol Thapar, who I think was considered and was in the final group. We had a lot of discussions about the confirmation process. I thought Kavanaugh was uniquely qualified. He did have one challenge, and that was a lot of paper. He'd been in a lot of different public positions. And I said, I don't think this is an argument not to nominate him, but I think one of the plays they'll try on Kavanaugh is we need to see every piece of paper that ever crossed his desk. And as you know, they did. We gave them most of what I think anybody would have needed, and it was more paper than was ever provided by any nominee in history by far. But that clearly was sort of, you know, petering out. It wasn't working for them. And then you saw the next play, the leaked allegation, apparently without the permission of the person who was making the allegations. And the intensity of all of this. All of it was really related to only a handful of votes because everybody decided how they're going to vote anyway, even before that happened. The opposition on the other side had a lot of signs that didn't have a name filled in yet. As soon as the nomination was made, they filled in the names. So they were ready to go no matter what, much before this last minute allegation. So the question then was, you know, what's a responsible way to deal with it? And it was clear we had to have another hearing. We had to give the person who was making the accusations an opportunity to be heard. Kavanaugh wanted to be heard. After all, his whole reputation was on the line after all of these years, and certainly he wanted to be able to speak. He did. She did, and he did. You watched it. Everybody in the country was focused like a laser on it. And then one of my members, Senator Flake, decided there ought to be an additional FBI investigation. So what I did, that was on a Friday afternoon, I had over my office the Republican members of the Judiciary Committee plus Senator Collins and Senator Murkowski, and we discussed, what more do you need to see? And out of that meeting, we agreed that a subsequent FBI investigation, this would have been, by the way, the seventh FBI investigation for Brett Kavanaugh, would be done within a week, and the scope of it would be anybody Dr. Ford mentioned who might corroborate her story. And there was a woman at Yale, an undergraduate school, who made a number of allegations. We talked to her and anybody she mentioned. The FBI did that within that week. The FBI report was ready on Thursday, the next Thursday. That's Friday to the next Thursday. They ended up talking to 8 or 10 people. And then there was confusion about what an FBI report is. And the Democrats said, oh, we need copies. Well, fortunately, there was a memorandum between President Obama and Senator Leahy, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, about how you handle FBI reports. Democratic president, Democratic chairman of the Judiciary Committee. FBI report is not to be copied. It's the property of the executive branch. Only senators can look at it. So we're not copying the FBI report. But I told the staff, stay up all night. Anybody who wants to read it can. And a number of people did. But the people that were most important who needed to read it were Murkowski, Collins, and Blake. By Friday morning, all three of them agreed there was no corroborating evidence. None. And so what ended up being on trial was the presumption of innocence itself. For my own sake, I had a unique experience during that week. If you're a leader of one of the parties, you might have noticed, you end up typically having not very good approval ratings because you're always getting sort of beat up by somebody or another. And, the president, whoever that is, always has a huge audience. But none of the rest of us have that big an audience. But that particular week, while all of that was going on, every speech I made, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, was carried live on all the cables from beginning to end. Never had an audience like that. And the two things I argued were the presumption of innocence is fundamental in America, and we're not going to be intimidated by this angry mob that was chasing my members to their homes. You're familiar with some restaurant episodes in our state. And in the halls of the Capitol, I mean, getting right up in their faces and trying to intimidate them. In retrospect, I think it actually helped us. The tactics, I think, were very helpful in the end. We're used to people demonstrating. They're doing it all the time in Washington on one thing or another. This was very different. This was actually an effort to physically intimidate. Senator Collins went home one night in Washington. There was somebody in front of her house shining a light in her face. So I tried to make this about presumption of innocence and the tactics of the angry mob. And according to CNN, my approval rating among Republicans in the country went from 30 to 62. I know it won't last very long, but I'm sort of savoring the moment. And I thought the most statesmanlike, one of the most statesmanlike speeches I've ever heard was Senator Collins' speech. She was under unbelievably intense pressure. There were people in her home state bringing coat hangers to her house, to her offices, harassing her in the airport on the way back and forth to Washington. She, of all my members who were under assault, she was under the biggest assault. And yet she stood up, worked her way through that, cared about what the facts were, stood up for the presumption of innocence, stood up to the angriest mob. She had the angriest mob of all, and did the right thing, in my opinion. So I was really, really proud of her and proud of all of our members for not being rolled over by this. One final thought, then I'll throw it open for what you'd like to ask about. The circuit judges are also important, and we have now confirmed 29, which is a record for this early in any administration. If we're able to hold on to the majority for two more years, we're going to continue to do that. If we were to lose the majority, I expect it will slow to a trickle. But this is an opportunity, I think, to have a long-term impact on the country. I'm proud of the three new circuit judges from Kentucky, Emil Zipar, John Bush, and John Nalbandian. I think they'll be there a long time, that's what I hope, and have a really positive impact on our country. So with that, why don't we see what you'd like to talk about. Good grief. Yeah. Yeah. It is. It is. That's strong, by the way. That's strong. That's accurate. Yeah. Can you give him a microphone you have in your hand?
I just wanted to ask you about some of the lower court nominees have been not opining on any Supreme Court decisions on whether they think they're correctly decided or not, including Brown v. Board of Education. And I was just wondering if you think that was a wise
tactic. Well, Brown is an exception. I think most everybody has answered the Brown question. But that's about it. Most of them have been really guarded, no matter whether they were appointed by a Democrat or a Republican. I think the message after Bork was, this is only going to be a problem for me if I start. Anyway, yeah, they do answer Brown.
Anybody else?
I can't imagine you all are so, there you go.
I was just wondering your thoughts on, you spoke about what the political climate looks like today. Is there any way for us to have a cooling off period to where it's returned, where the rhetoric's not up here and it actually returns back to normal?
It's terrible. Yeah, and I think there's been a lot of contribution to it on both sides. I think the whole country's been on edge. I hope it settles down after the election. I think you're going to see, for an off-year election, a really big turnout. A lot of people I personally wish would stay home are going to show up. And it's not good. It's not good. If you're looking for a way to feel better, though, let me have a book recommendation for you. John Meacham, Soul of America. And it's been out about 6 months. And what Meacham does is sort of go back and take you through American history and our various low points and how we dealt with it and how we came back. It's really quite reassuring. And we've had these phases. One I always like to mention because it's a Democrat. Woodrow Wilson debuted Birth of a Nation in the White House, which led to the resurgence of the Klan in the 1920s. So we've had a number of different low moments, but the country always is so good at rebounding, and I think that's generally reflected in elections. So we'll see what happens, but we'll get past this. Scalia, once again, my favorite person to quote, used to say that every 10-horned dictator in the world's got a Bill of Rights, but what preserves America is the separation of powers. And no matter who you may be irritated at any given moment, almost nobody has the authority to do anything unchecked. The brilliant people who put this government together made it sure that nobody was unchecked. And so I think the separation of powers, the division of responsibility throughout the government is a great check on government abuse. And then we periodically have these outbreaks, such as the one I started off with. I mean, what happened in Kroger and what happened in the synagogue? Awful, just awful. And sometimes these moments bring us more together rather than pushing us further apart because of our shared revulsion at what we witness.
Mine's not a question, at the risk of embarrassing you, having known you a long time. I want to congratulate you and thank you personally for spearheading what I deem to be the most consequential period for conservative governance that I've had the privilege of witnessing in my lifetime. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.